I get asked a lot, do I regret selling to Amazon? We sold to Amazon now 7 years ago. Do you regret it? And the honest answer is, I regret that the circumstances made that the best alternative for Whole Foods.
Welcome to the Jonathan Kaiser Podcast. This is a show that highlights successful business leaders and entrepreneurs from Arizona and beyond. I'm your host, Jonathan Kaiser. Entrepreneur, CEO, father, and best-selling author. As the founder and managing partner of Kaiser Commercial Real Estate, I've been very fortunate to be able to connect with some of the smartest and most brilliant people in our country. And now, I want to tell their stories. Join me as I interview world-class executives and entrepreneurs, exploring their journeys, end games, the challenges they've overcome, and how you can model their success. Welcome back, everyone, to the Jonathan Kaiser Podcast. It is my distinct honor today to be able to introduce a good friend, longtime business mentor of mine, and someone that really has shifted the consciousness of the business world in a meaningful way, Mr. John Mackey, co-founder and CEO for 44 years of Whole Foods. Welcome, my friend.
Thanks for having me on, Jonathan. Good to see you again.
Great to see you. So we're here. And for those who are on video, you can see the stack of books behind me here. John originally co-wrote the Conscious Capitalism book. That was kind of the first time that I had been introduced to the fundamental concepts of conscious capitalism. John, can you just talk in a really high level about that as a starting point as we kind of dive into this conversation about your new book?
Sure. Conscious capitalism, it is capitalism. I always have to want to now preface it because there's so much confusion. It's not socialism. It's capitalism. It's shareholder capitalism. It's not an economic system. It's not a governing philosophy or governance structure. It's really a management philosophy, how you should manage your business. And we have three principles or four principles in the book we call the pillars of conscious capitalism. The first one is every business has this potential for a higher purpose besides just making money. Again, nothing wrong with making money. If business doesn't make money, it'll die. Mm-hmm. Profits are the lifeblood of business. Yep. But similarly to what Ed Freeman says, the founder of stakeholder theory, that my body has to produce red blood cells or I'll die. But it doesn't logically follow that that therefore is the purpose of my life is to produce red blood cells. It's necessary, but not the purpose. And similarly, doctors, they make a lot of money, but that's not their purpose to make money. Their purpose is to help heal people. Teachers also are paid, but they educate. Engineers construct things. Architects design things. Every one of the professions refers back to some type of service that they are doing for other people, and money is exchanged for those services. Well, business is no different. It's the greatest value creator in the world. And ultimately, business, the higher purpose of every business will refer back to in some form or fashion to the value that they're creating for their customers in goods and services or whatever else it is that they're trading with their customers. So that purpose needs to be articulated. It can be inspiring to the business. It's the North Star. For example, Whole Foods, its purpose, what higher purpose was to nourish people in the planet. We're in the food business. We're selling healthy food. We're trying to nourish people. And that nourishment is not just for food. We wanted to create a type of culture that was caring and people love to work at Whole Foods, be one of the best companies to work for in America for 20 consecutive years. Okay. Second pillar, besides after you get past higher purpose, is that all stakeholders matter. There's a sort of stakeholder interdependence. And by stakeholders, I mean customers are a stakeholder. That means they have a stake in the business and they're trading with the business voluntarily. So customers have a stake, they trade. Employees have a stake, they trade. Suppliers have a stake, they trade. Investors have a stake, they trade. And communities that we're part of, they have a stake and they also trade with the business.
Right.
And once you understand that they're all important, they're not all equally important. That's something I think is confused today that I'll make a statement of. So clearly, a business exists to create value for customers. So in my mind, the customer is the most important stakeholder. And since you don't even need employees, they don't come until later, the second most important stakeholder are the owners of the business. So those are the big two. And then very shortly, as you grow a business, you begin to have employees. And so they become important because they're the ones creating value for the customers. And if they're unhappy, then you're going to probably have unhappy customers too. And then suppliers, every business has to be getting, whether it be energy or water or electricity or the goods that you might be turning into something else, your manufacturing. We all have a variety of suppliers. Whole Foods had tens of thousands of suppliers, for example, all around the world for that matter. Mm-hmm. So all these stakeholders are sort of interdependent. And once you begin to see that, then you can manage the business more consciously so that you're creating these win-win-win scenarios so that all the stakeholders are benefiting. But there are always going to be some trade-offs in business, but the conscious business is seeking to minimize those trade-offs, seeking to create the most value for their customers and all their other stakeholders in a conscious way. The third principle of conscious capitalism is that we need a different kind of leader. Leaders that are not just there to line their own pockets and make as much money as possible while they're leading the business. We need leaders that are trying to fulfill the higher purpose of the business and that are servant leaders. They're in service to the higher purpose of the business. They're in service to the stakeholders. That's really what their job is. And so I really believe in that concept of conscious leadership. And then fourth, it's about creating cultures that allow human beings to flourish. It's very interesting today when we have some of these remote work cultures that have popped up after COVID. I kind of believe in a hybrid model, not to get us too far afield on that one. It's good that we can not have to be in the office every day, but it's very hard to maintain a culture if you're not connecting in person. In the brave new world we're in, we have to find ways to create cultures that allow human beings to flourish while also allowing some remote work in some cases, some of the time. So those are the four pillars: higher purpose, all stakeholders matter and are interdependent, conscious leadership, and a conscious culture. And that's what we wrote the book about. Those are the four principles.
Yeah. And you know, for me, I've met a lot of leaders and I have gotten to know a lot of leaders and I've read a lot of leaders' books. And for me, what's different about you, and I know you're humble and you'll probably brush off this compliment, but it's very, very true for me, is of all the mentors and leaders in my life that are kind of out there pushing the envelope on a number of different important issues, to me, you really walk the walk. I mean, I've gotten to know you personally. You know, you've been kind enough to let me stay at your home. I have seen firsthand the truth in the message. And so for me, it's one thing to write a book. It's another thing to create an entire movement. And I would suggest, and I'm sure that there's others that, you know, have contributed as well, but I would suggest that the single biggest factor in transforming business as a force for good in the world in this century has been the movement of conscious capitalism. And I remember the first time I walked into a Conscious Capital CEO Summit and I looked around and I listened to what was being talked about and I met the people. And here I am thinking I'm out on an island talking about loving and serving and helping people and changing an industry, a really cutthroat commercial real estate brokerage industry through love and service. And everybody I talked to, they're like, oh yeah, that's what we're doing as well. And I'm like, wow, I finally found my tribe. This is amazing. Yeah. You know, so maybe talk a little about the movement, because I think it even led to the Business Roundtable kind of shifting some of their philosophies in a public way.
Well, thank you. That's a very high compliment. I will brush it off. It's not really fundamentally true. I think we're part of a larger movement. I actually feel like conscious capitalism is actually under attack. It's under attack from two sides, both misunderstanding what it is. I want to circle back to what I said previously. It's a management philosophy. It's not an economic system, nor is it a governance. It's meant to be a set of governance laws and regulations. And that's where the confusion comes in, because a lot of the traditional the shareholder capitalists are attacking it because they're afraid that this is like a Trojan horse, sheep in wolf's clothing, attempting to take power and control of corporations away from the owners and redistribute it to various stakeholders. And so that the profits would be redistributed and you no longer have the owners controlling the business. And that is not what conscious capitalism is, but we're constantly being attacked by people from the shareholders because they think that's what it is.
So what's the counter to that? If that's the concern, what's the response?
My response to traditional shareholder capitalists is we have no conflict. I believe the business should be controlled by the owners. But think about it. The owners get paid last in all these exchanges. They get paid last after everybody else is getting paid. Think about it. Let's take a grocery store as an example. So Our customers get paid. They come in, they get their goods. Sometimes they actually, if they go to the prepared foods, they might even eat their food before they have to pay for it. But they're getting paid. They're taking those goods and services and leaving the store, and they're paying for it, and they're getting paid. The exchange is happening right then. There's no delay in time, right? Now, team members or employees, they work and they get paid every 2 weeks. So they're putting their labor out first, and then they're getting paid for that labor within a 2 week span. Suppliers have a longer time horizon. In the grocery business, it's usually 30 days. In the book business, which I also happen to be in, it's usually can be up to 6 months or even a year sometimes before they have to pay. And so in the grocery business, it's 30 days, and usually you get a discount if you are net 10.
Right.
You get 1 or 2% discount to pay within 10. So most people want that discount, so they pay within 10 days. So when does the government get paid, or when does the communities that we're part of that provide energy, and they're getting paid usually within 30 days, or if they're taking employment taxes, they're getting paid every couple of weeks. And they may not get their, and if you're a very profitable company, they're going to want you to pay quarterly income taxes if you're in a state that charges corporate taxes, income taxes. So the communities and government are getting paid as they go along. When do the investors get paid? Well, first of all, they don't get paid at all if there's nothing left over. So people are always wanting to redistribute profits, and there may not even be any profits. It's hard to make money in business. Business is a very, very challenging.
And it can be a loss.
Yes, of course. It's a love life. You know, it's got a burn rate. We're burning capital. We have a loss every single day. The day we're open at this point, we don't have enough business to cover our overhead. So we think that we'll change that, but that's where we are right now.
Yeah.
So the investors get paid last. And if they lose control of the business, they may not get paid last. They may not get paid at all, or what they get paid will be very little. And so ultimately, that's why the investors need to maintain control of the business. So conscious capitalism is not about taking that control away from the owners. And once I explain that to the people attacking conscious capitalism from the shareholder perspective, they agree, but they say, well, you're being conscious capitalism being misunderstood then. And yes, it is being misunderstood. But then I have to go to see where it's being attacked next. It's being attacked by, we'll call it, the anti-capitalist, are trying to weaponize conscious capitalism as a method to take power from traditional capitalists. And that's why we're stuck in this middle, where their goal is, because they're anti-capitalist, they want to take the profits away, they want to take the control away, and they're using sort of stakeholders as a strategy to try to take it away. Well, all stakeholders matter, right? So let's have labor on the board, and we'll have a supplier group on the board, and we'll have the government on the board. We'll have customer representations on the board, and then you can have your owner representation on the board. You're like one of five representatives on the board, and then collectively they'll decide what to do with, they'll control the company. So that'd be the end of capitalism as we know it. But you have to see, that's conscious capitalism's kind of caught in this conflict between the anti-capitalist, traditional capitalist, when in fact, conscious capitalism is a management strategy. It's a way to manage your business in a more conscious way. And so that's how conscious capitalism is being misunderstood today, right? Pretty much by everybody.
So how do we change that? I mean, how do we fix that misunderstanding outside of podcasts like this one?
I don't know how to fix it, except, but you just gave the solution. You have to continue to be stating what you are and what you're not. It's a sad truth that once your brand goes out into the world, to a certain extent, you lose control of it. And people, they can make it into something and it's not. And I'm deeply worried that might be happening to conscious capitalism.
Well, yeah. And I think that's a good segue, too. So the third pillar of what you talked about was your second book. And I was very humbled and honored to be one of the people that you highlighted. And again, I will say that I often feel the same way as you, where I'm not sure that I deserve the credit and the accolades, but certainly our intentions are there. But maybe just talk briefly about that, and then we'll get to the new book, because I think it's a progressive story, right? It's a story of conscious capitalism through to the tell-all that you just recently wrote.
Conscious Leadership, the origin of that book, and I had two co-authors with me on it, my good friends, Carter Phipps and Steve McIntosh. We wrote the book collectively, but we each had three chapters. There are nine chapters. We had three chapters we each focused on. And I think the heart of the book are the principles of conscious leadership that we articulate early on. So some of those are right out of conscious capitalism, right? The first one is have a higher purpose. So purpose is right there at the beginning of conscious leadership. So it's a fundamental piece for not only conscious capitalism, but conscious leadership. By the way, the origins of this book are that we have a section in conscious capitalism about conscious leadership. That book came out in 2013 and conscious leadership was published in 2020. And in that 7-year gap, I heard again and again and again more questions about, you don't write enough about leadership. We need to know, because all these business people would come to conscious capitalism and they wanted to know, how do we operationalize this? These are great ideals, but how do we do it in the real world? So we need to know more about conscious leadership. So writing the book Conscious Leadership was an attempt to address that gap. And I think we did address it. The first principle that we articulate in both conscious capitalism, conscious leadership. Second, then we talk about leading with love. And that is, love and leadership are seldom found together in a business context. That already shocks people. That's a coin that comes up all the time as I'm on this whole story, because I talk a lot about love at the whole story on my book tour right now. But love is absolutely critical to being effective leaders, in my opinion. If you're not going to have just a strictly professional culture, if you're going to have a more human culture, then people have to be able to be, show up and be kind of their more authentic self and not just a professional persona.
Yeah.
And if the work's going to be satisfying to them. And of course, being authentic and being themselves means you have to bring love into the workplace. By love, I don't mean romantic love. I don't mean sex. That can be a different topic. But it does mean that we care about the people we work with. They're our friends. We develop relationships with them. And they care about us. We care about them. So a lot of people just segregate their work. When I go into the office or I go into the workplace, I put on my professional persona and I leave my friendships, my love, my family, all the things that are most important to me, they're not in here. And I just think that's not very human. I don't think that's very fulfilling. So I believe the love has to come into the workplace with you. And that just means having an open heart and caring. And a leader leads with love. And that doesn't mean they can't make tough decisions. It means, though, that they're going to make decisions that are in interest of the whole organization and all the stakeholders, and particularly the customers and the investors and then team members, employees. But the other stakeholders are also important. And love just means caring. I mean, part of the reason you're going to make those decisions is that you are acting with love. You lead with love. You care about the people you work with. And even when you have to make a difficult decision by like having to let somebody go, you can still do that from the place of love, of genuinely caring about them and generally trying to help them find another place, another job. It's the mistake is that people think they have to be tough to be masculine. They have to cut off this loving part of their being. And the art of it is to be able to be both integrated, to be both strong and loving, masculine and feminine. We need both of those energies in our workplace. So leading with love is a very important thing. I talk a lot about it. I actually did author that chapter originally in the book, although, of course, Carter and Steve improved on it. That's one that was really important to me. And,
well, I just on that point, I remember your presentation on love at Conscious Capitalism a few years ago.
Yeah.
And that was profoundly moving for me. It was the first time I'd heard a leader get up and speak on the topic of love. Again, in our business, I use the word love a lot. And at the beginning, it was more heightened. But even today, people look at me a little sideways when I say the word. But it really is such a critical part of what we've done.
You have to walk the talk. Right. Yeah. You have to show up. And that's why I say you have to lead with love. And if you want to have love at your workplace, you can't just talk about it. You have to demonstrate it. And, you know, one of the things that I talk about this all the time when I talk about love, if you want to have more work, a love in your workplace, start with ending your meetings with appreciations. You cannot do an authentic appreciation of someone without opening your heart. People know the difference between flattery and actual authentic love. And they know the difference. And so they can tell when you're playing, you know, well, most people can know the difference most of the time. You can sometimes fool people for sure. At Whole Foods, when we did appreciations, there's so much judgment that goes on in a meeting. You're judging people. What a windbag. You know, that person will, you know, it's like their ideas are not cogent. I wish they'd just move off this topic. And there's lots of judgment that's going on in meetings. And judgments are the opposite of love. When you're criticizing and attacking, you're not really in your heart, you're not really loving. So appreciations are a way, when the meeting's ending, for people to reconnect in a heartfelt way. They're not mandatory, you're not forced to do it, but people have the opportunity to do it. And of course, if you're the leader, you have to lead by example. So I would always, almost always start out appreciations to get it established. But then once people get used to it, they like it. It feels good to tell people that, to thank people for things that they've done for them and to be thanked.
100%.
So anyway, lead with love. Then next principle is integrity in all things. Integrity is a, like love, it's complicated. Love has many attributes to it, generosity, kindness, compassion, forgiveness. These are all types of love that are all manifestations of love. Well, similarly, integrity has honesty, truth-telling, authenticity, trustworthiness. These are all types of integrity. So integrity in all things has to be a guiding principle in the conscious leader. We act with integrity. We tell the truth. We don't lie to people. If we make a promise, we keep it. We show up as we really are. We don't try to deceive people by pretending to be something we're not. We give trust to people. We assume good intent. We give trust, even though sometimes that trust may be betrayed and we have to change, but we assume good intent until trust has been broken. So integrity in all things we do. And I have found integrity not to be extremely rare, but it's also not that common either. We could use a lot more integrity in our business.
Well, and it's not like it's a zero-sum game either, right? There's times where I catch myself out of integrity and I got to realign.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like a, like you said, it's a North Star.
The fourth principle I'm going to talk about, and then we'll leave conscious leadership, although there's a lot more to the book, is find win-win-win solutions.
My favorite one out of that. I got so much from that point.
And by win-win-win, it means good for you, good for me, and good for all of us. And people say, well, I don't know why you need that third win. And I say, well, you could hire a hitman to kill your wife. That might be good for you. It might be good for the hitman you're paying him, but it wouldn't be obviously good for your wife, and it wouldn't be good for our larger society if murder is what you're doing.
Right, right.
So the third win is important. And the interesting thing about, if you start to think win-win-win in every negotiation, in every situation you're in, not only will you transform your life and the way you conduct business, the win-win-win is almost a complete ethical system. If that's all you did in every circumstance is do a win-win-win, you would find you wouldn't have any more ethical quandaries any longer. They disappear.
What I remember from our personal conversations about this topic after I read the book the first time is I remember you saying they're not always the easiest to find. You have to work a little harder to find them.
Yeah.
But when you do, they're more sustainable. They're more long-lasting. So it's not just that they're the right thing to do, right? It's tying the right thing to do. And that's the point for me that I love most about conscious capitalism. And you talk about it in the whole story, which, again, I think is a groundbreaking book that everybody should read. But it's this idea of just because you're doing the right thing, it doesn't mean you're just doing the right thing for right thing's sake, and that's valuable, but it also has positive consequences throughout your business and throughout your life. And I think I call that the kind of the additional, the extra stuff, but that becomes almost a reason in and of itself to do it outside of just the fact that it's the right thing to do. Would you agree with that comment?
I not only agree with it, I'll take it a little bit further. It's been my experience in life that we get back exactly what we give. The giving and receiving are not like opposites. Giving is not a type of sacrifice. As we give, as we share love, as we look for win-win-win solutions in all circumstances, that comes back to us. The universe is like a mirror, or we're in a dream. And as we act more loving in the dream, then people are more loving towards us. As we care more, so are we cared more for. So if we are trustworthy, we find other people that are trustworthy back to us. It's like we can kind of create in our own circle of relationships, we can begin to create circles of love where kindnesses are repaid, love is reciprocated, compassion comes back to you. So that's the paradox. The more caring we are, the more we're cared for. It's not really a paradox. It's just sort of a universal principle. If we act win-win-win, people will begin to act win-win-win with us. We get back what we give. So once you're conscious of that, give love, give kindness, seek win-win-win solutions. And if think about that. If everybody did that, we would transform the world.
I wrote about that in my book, right? The whole idea of imagine a world where everyone selflessly helped each other, regardless of personal gain, understanding that it is in their own personal best interest to do so. If everybody acted that way, imagine the good we could unlock in the world. Imagine the opportunity for everyone we could create.
It's true. Now, but if you try to make that compulsive, which
that's
is what
no longer a choice,
which is what socialism tries to do, then it becomes exploitative. It's like, well, I want you to give, but you know, I'm going to ensure that you do. Well, now you've just entered into the beginnings of a totalitarian culture. So I'm talking about pure voluntary love and caring. And by the way, when people betray your trust, you have to step backwards with that individual, ready to forgive, perhaps in the future and give another chance, but also now still loving them, but not letting them take advantage of you and your loved ones again. So it's a dance.
Well, and for someone like you who has built such an extraordinary organization that leaves a legacy and is one of the kind of the icons today of business leadership, it's not like you're some talking head in some university somewhere just sort of conceptualizing. You've lived the real story, and I would say the whole story in this book. What was notable to me was how much of the real John Mackey was just sort of highlighted in your emotions and your thoughts. Can you talk about what led, having already done two groundbreaking works, what led you to want to write the whole story?
Yeah, thank you. That's a really great question, Jonathan. And I had a multiplicity of reasons for wanting to write this book. The first reason was it's kind of my final gift to Whole Foods Market. It's a final gift. I'm no longer CEO. I led it for 44 years. I created it. I co-created it. I nurtured it. All the other founders, even the longest one, left 25 years before I did. So all the founders left pretty early, relatively, in the story. In doing a little research, I discovered that over 1 million people have worked for our company.
Wow.
I know, exactly. There's 120,000 working for it right now. And so over 1 million people have worked for it. So I dedicated the book to team members, past, all team members, past, present, and future. And this is our story. Now that it's a big corporation, people don't see the entrepreneurial roots to it. They don't know that it was one little tiny store and that a bunch of hippies were starting the business up and we had these high ideals about food. One of the reasons Whole Foods was so innovative in sort of the HR is because none of us came from big corporations. We didn't have that experience. We were free to invent and create something a little bit unique and different. And just like you discovered that you weren't alone, it was a shock to me when I first read Raj Sisodia's book, Firms of Endearment, that Whole Foods was not the only company that was this way, that we were part of a community of companies that were trying to do what we were doing. So that's the first reason, is a gift to the team members and a gift to Whole Foods. It was also a way for me to get closure. Whole Foods is like my daughter, but it's 44 years old. Now it's 46 years old, but 44, almost 46, but 44 when I created it back in 1978 or co-created it, co-founded it. And we always love our children and we always will. We're always going to care about them, but they do grow up and they do leave home and you've got to let them go their own way. And this was more for my sake. This second reason was for my sake. In order for me to be able to transition away, I had to feel like I got closure.
Yes.
And that was important. And the third reason is that I advise everyone to write a memoir, because looking back retrospectively, I discovered so many things about myself. New patterns emerged as I looked back and worked through it systematically. The whole thing was an incredibly learning experience. And things I didn't understand became clear to me looking backwards and seeing the pattern emerge. It was a self-discovery process. I knew more about who I was when I finished writing the book. It was an amazing journey. It took 3 years to write that book and to get it published. So that's the third reason. And the fourth reason, ultimately, I think it's a good tale. And the world, I thought the world should hear it. It's a good tale. I think entrepreneurs are very inspired by this book. Mickey Agrawal just published on Instagram yesterday her reaction when she finished reading the book. It was one of the best books, one of the best books she's ever read. She was crying. It so spoke to her heart. She totally identified with so many of the challenges and struggles we went through. And that, of course, you know, made me feel fantastic because that's what every author seeks. But the point is that I wrote it for people like Mickey. Mm-hmm. She's a serial entrepreneur. Entrepreneurs are highly creative people. They go through some highs and lows in building their businesses. And I wrote it to hopefully inspire people for maybe decades to come about this was a story of Whole Foods and this was a story. And I tried to do it in this very authentic, open way. And it's just a narrative. It's just one story after another. We wrote the book by telling us stories at certain periods of time. And in the story, I could show how the company was evolving and changing and how I was changing as a leader and as a human being. It also is my own spiritual journey of awakening deeper and deeper and deeper into care and love.
Well, I think it's extraordinary for all of those reasons. What I think stood out to me the most, and what has always stood out to me with you, is the authenticity in it. And a lot of times, especially when you have an association with a certain ideal like conscious capitalism, people make assumptions that it's all just love, butterflies, and rainbows, and they don't understand some of the really challenging scenarios you had to go through. I'm just going to grab a couple pieces from this book and ask you about them.
Sure.
On page 125, you say this: as much as I want to build cooperative relationships with all my partners, it wasn't always possible to do so successfully. Human beings are also wired to compete. We envy those we perceive as having more success, attractiveness, wealth, fame, power, and so on. And we have a tendency to insist on the fundamental rightness of our own versions of reality, even when it comes at great personal cost. I was learning all these lessons even as I was trying to become more skilled at balancing the inevitable authority of my leadership position with my desire to collaborate and share. Wow, that paragraph hit me when I read that. I would love for you to expand upon that because that's such a powerful, it's the yin and the yang. It's trying to figure out how you be a successful business leader and do the tough things while still leading with love. Can you comment on that?
Of course, I didn't offer an answer. That itself was partly coming from a letter I wrote to an ex-girlfriend that I was sharing some of my own thinking about it. And researching the book, I was rereading a lot of the stuff that I wrote many, many years ago. And I thought, wow, this one's good. Maybe it should be in the book. And I've always been puzzled by the paradox of cooperation and competition, because both are sort of baked into this particular reality that we're in. If you think about natural selection, it's highly competitive, and business is highly competitive. And when competition is taken to an extreme, it becomes war and you kill. So even in business, there are limits, except for the mafia and gangster type businesses. There's a limit. There's rules that you can't take competition past this point, or you go to jail. You can't murder your competitors to eliminate them. You have to figure out another way to outcompete them with better products and better services. But if countries are competing, they might be competing, but war is the destruction. And I'm trying to say the dark side of competition, that the darkest side is murder on the one hand and war on the other hand, where you basically are no longer playing by any rules. You're just trying to kill or destroy those who oppose you. Well, cooperation. But then there's a healthy form of competition, right? We know in games and sports that having competitors, they push us to be better, push us to innovate, push us to be creative, push us to make our products and services better. And so there's this positive side of competition. One of the greatest examples I like to use to people, I don't know if you're a tennis fan at all, but the three greatest tennis players in the history of the world, they've won the most Grand Slams: Djokovic, Federer, Nadal. These three tennis players, they all played at the same time, and they all were striving to beat the other ones. And so that lifted each of their games higher and higher and higher. And there's this period of time from when these guys were in their 20 years old to now they're, Federer is the oldest and he's about close to 40, and Djokovic is the youngest and he's now surpassed Nadal and Federer in total Grand Slams won. I think he's got about 20 or 21 now. But no one else, very few other people in the last 20 years won a Grand Slam besides these three guys. They totally dominated tennis. All the rest of the Grand Slams are less than each of them personally won combined in the last 20 years. I know. So that's the healthy form of competition, right? They couldn't go out and kill each other to eliminate them. They had to improve their tennis game. So there's this healthy side of competition that brings out the very best in us. And there's a destructive side of competition where we try to destroy or kill those that are our enemies. Well, cooperation is similar. There's this healthy side of cooperation where we work together and cooperatively. We see this in teams, whether it be team sports, we see it, can see it in corporations where we're cooperating together and our joint product, the sum is greater than the whole of the parts. It's what, there's the synergies. Sometimes my best ideas, I come up with a good idea, but then somebody else iterates and builds on that idea. And then I build on it again. And we have this positive upward spiral of innovation occurring. We see this in our corporations all the time. And what happens when you have these great companies compete with each other? We're seeing it now in AI, but we saw it with the internet. You could see it in search. Now we're seeing it in electrical vehicles. With Tesla was a trailblazer, but now we're seeing other entrants come in. So there's this healthy side of cooperation. And yet there's also a downside to cooperation. The downside, if you have to get complete agreement all the time, that no one can disagree, that cooperation is sought as the opposite of competition, and cooperation is good and competition is bad, so we just need to only cooperate. You end up with sort of bureaucracy, stultifying, lack of creativity, and you basically, progress stops. So what I'm trying to do in the book there is say, these are the paradox. Evolution is a synthesis of both competition and cooperation. So is capitalism. So is the economic ecosystem of innovation and creativity. It has rules. There's limits to competition, but the competition is being channeled cooperatively to make progress. So that's what I was trying to do there. And it's the same way in our relationships. These are fundamental principles of reality. We are both beings. It's built into our DNA. We both cooperate and we compete. And there are healthy forms of both of those, and there are unhealthy forms of both of them.
That's why I love that paragraph. I thought it was such a beautiful sort of snapshot of that. And I think that's, you know, one of many leaders' biggest challenges is trying to walk that, find that balance. And it's an ever-moving needle, right? Because things change. So
we have to change with them.
We have to change with them. I'm going to jump to another part in the book on page 259, where you're talking about your letter of complaint from the NLRB. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because as someone who's built an organization with such a focus on helping people and being a collaborative workforce, to me, that was an interesting highlight that kind of punched you in the gut.
Yeah, what we're talking about here, what Jonathan's referring to, is back in the year 2002, Whole Foods Market, one of our stores in Madison, Wisconsin, there had been a professor, a political philosophy professor, whose class project that summer was to unionize Whole Foods Market. And so several of the students hired into the store, and they organized the store. And we had a union vote, and we lost that vote. And so a union was voted in. And we had about 150 stores about that at that period of time. And for me, that was a complete wake-up call, because it was like, wow. I always thought Whole Foods was one of the 100 best companies to work for. It had been named at that time 4 or 5 years in a row, and we went on to be named 20 consecutive years in a row until Amazon bought us, and then we really weren't eligible to play that any longer because we were part of Amazon. We weren't a separate corporation any longer. So to me, it was a total wake-up call. For it's like, okay, I began to think of the union differently. I saw them now as a competitor. How were they a competitor? They were a competitor to the hearts and minds and loyalty of our workforce. If we didn't do a good job of taking care of our people and helping them be happy, giving them competitive compensation, competitive benefits, helping them to have an opportunity to learn and grow and get more responsibility and higher pay. If we fail to do that, then the union's message would find welcome amongst our employees. So I decided to make a trip. I visited all 150 stores in the next year.
Which is incredible for a CEO to do.
Yeah, I visited all 150. I talked with the team members. The overwhelming question I kept asking, how do we make Whole Foods Market the very best company in the world to work for? That was the challenge that I put out to each person as I went around, or each store as I went around. I mean, obviously, of course, we heard you need to pay better. We heard that every time, every place we went. But we heard lots of other things. And one of the most important ones we heard was we needed to really improve our health benefits. We need to be more aware in our communications. We weren't doing as good a job communicating. So we made, after doing this, while we were doing this, we were making the changes as we went along. And we improved our health benefits. One of the things that when we were younger, and the team members were younger, when whole, you know, 20 years before, 24 years before when we got started, people didn't have very many healthcare needs. But now they were middle-aged and they had families. They needed better healthcare. So yeah, we radically improved our healthcare. We changed some of our communication policies to make sure the team members were in the loop. We opened up for more participation of team members on things. We started a benefits vote, for example, so team members could vote on which benefits they wanted. So that happened for all 149 stores, all 150 stores but one. And that one store was Madison, because Madison had a union and the union was representing it. The union made all these types of promises to the team members of what they could do if they voted a union in. But all Whole Foods had to agree to do was we had to negotiate in good faith, which we did. And what ended up happening is everybody except Madison got better healthcare benefits. Everybody but Madison got different communication, different cooperation profiles. But Madison was denied all the improvements we made the rest of the store because we offered it to them, but the union wouldn't let them have it because he said, we're negotiating for you. And so to cut to the end, at the end of 1 year, the team members of Madison decertified the union. They said, you really haven't delivered anything to us. We want what the rest of the stores have. But and more importantly, those organizers, as soon as they'd gotten A's on their class project for the summer, and then they quit. They weren't longtime Whole Fooders. They didn't care. They went on and did whatever they did after that. And so the point I'm trying to make here is that the unions made Whole Foods Market better. And by competing, you might say, for the loyalty of our team members. So I see unions as a good thing. If you're not a good employer, your employees have options. They can unionize. And that's a good thing, because if you're mistreating people, then they should have a right to, they can quit always and get another job, but they also, they like the job and they like the place they're working. Perhaps they just need somebody to represent them in negotiations. So I wanted to make it so that no one would ever feel like they ever again needed a union to represent them and pay union dues to get for that privilege, that the company would care enough for them where the unions weren't necessary. So does that?
Yes. And I think that is exactly what I wanted you to highlight, because I think it's a lesson in a number of different things. One, leadership that actually is leaning into the love that you talk about throughout the whole story, right? This idea that you, if you actually care about your employees, to your point just now, unions aren't the enemy. Unions are just competition to help make sure that you're doing the right things that you stand by. I love that expression. And I think it's also an example on leadership, on how you deal with a situation like this. Many, many CEOs look at labor as the enemy and they're in a constant fight with them, rather than realizing that really the objective is to make their companies union proof, right? If you make your companies union proof because you are so good to your people, that's a whole different kind of approach than trying to just kind of be at war. So yeah, that, Jonathan, that struck me in reading that.
Yeah. So one of the things that the unions have said about me for years is wrong and inaccurate is that I'm anti-union. I've never been anti-union. The unions have played an important part in the evolution of corporations. They've helped get more rights for workers. They protected workers from abuse in many cases. So I'm not anti-union. I'm just trying to create a company that chooses not to have a union. They could choose a union. They just don't want to. That's not anti-union. I'd like to say that's beyond unions has been my goal. But if unions are necessary, and they are necessary in lots of corporations and lots of businesses and companies, then they should have unions.
100%. 100%. Another thing that I wanted to highlight from the book was your op-ed in the Wall Street Journal following your one of your long hikes, which was called The Whole Foods Alternative to Obamacare, 8 Things We Can Do to Improve Healthcare. And you did not anticipate the kind of reaction to that op-ed that you received. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal back in 2009. And I wrote it just before I was about to go on this 1-week hike in the 100-mile wilderness on the Appalachian Trail in Maine. I wasn't going to have any contact with civilization. So the last thing I did about midnight at night is I put the finishing touches and sent it. Then I went on my hike. And when I came off the hike, was able to turn my phone back on and get a signal, the phone blew up. And that week, it had been published immediately the next day or the next Monday. And people were upset. The progressives in particular were upset. And they were boycotting our stores. We had demonstrations in front of our stores. Our board was receiving hundreds, even then eventually thousands and thousands of letters and emails demanding I be fired. And it was a huge hubbub. And I just thought the reason this has actually come back up on my book tour, because one of the questions I get asked as I've talked to the business media again is, John, do you think corporations should take political stands on the issues of the day? And my answer is no, you should not. And that's why I retell this story about what happened to me when I took a stand. What I came to learn is that, and I, by the way, I stand by what I wrote. I still think it was a good op-ed piece. The reason it was controversial, it went against the progressive narrative, really, that I started out with a quote from Margaret Thatcher that the problem with socialism is you eventually run out of other people's money. That was at the top of the op-ed. And then towards the end, I talked about that healthcare was not, I did not believe it was an intrinsic right for healthcare, that we have a need for healthcare, but I feel like just like we have a need for food or shelter, and we have a need for lots of things, that free markets and capitalism is the best way to provide those goods and services. Not when you talk about people having a right to healthcare, you're saying that somebody else has to pay for it is really what you're saying. And I just don't think that's the best way to organize society. You can have a safety net for the poorest people, but in general, I believe that healthcare, like every other goods and service we use, do people have an intrinsic right to an iPhone? Do they have an intrinsic right to a Tesla or an automobile? Or where does it end?
Slippery slope.
Slippery slope. So the moral of the story here is that I thought, well, I'm just exercising my freedom of speech. I'm an American citizen. How can anybody object to that? Well, what they objected to was people could not distinguish between me and Whole Foods. I wasn't speaking for Whole Foods. I was speaking for me. I was giving my own opinions. These are my own private opinions. This was not something that Whole Foods Market endorsed or agreed with. But the world couldn't distinguish between me and Whole Foods. They were one and the same. And so that's what I tell when I was telling the media, well, would CEOs speak up on anything, whatever the issue is? It could be on racism. It could be on climate change. It could be on what's happening in Israel. It could be whatever you want. They're going to make enemies. They're going to piss a lot of people off, because the reality is we're kind of in these two big tribes, a blue tribe and a red tribe. They don't get along well. They hate each other. And people are forever trying to figure out which tribe you're in, because whether they're going to love you or hate you. So whenever you take a political stand, you're going to piss off 50%, approximately 50% of the population, and then they may take it out on your company. That's what they did with Whole Foods when I spoke up on healthcare. So that's my lesson. When you represent your corporation and you're the CEO, you sort of need to be a little more judicious in your freedom of speech rights, because there will be consequences to your business. And you're supposed to be, or I believe, a conscious leader who's a servant leader also, who's looking out for the good of the whole organization and all the stakeholders. So Whole Foods was harmed. The ironical thing, of course, is our sales actually went up. We got so much publicity from that thing that it brought in new business to the company. And we had people boycotting us. We also had people boycotting us who decided, well, I'm going to shop at Whole Foods anyway, yeah, or I'm going to shop more at Whole Foods. So it doesn't matter. The controversy, the hatred, team members were upset. It was very divisive. I didn't intend it that way. If you read my op-ed, I don't think it is divisive. It just questioned socialism, and it questioned whether people have an intrinsic right to healthcare. That's something you're not supposed to question. And if you do, it just shows you're a non-caring asshole. So anyway, that's what I have to say about that.
I appreciate the candor. Again, I think this podcast interview is an example of the, I mean, we're covering hard topics. I intentionally picked topics that were challenging because I believe that your willingness to stand in those challenging conversations and have authentic dialogue about them is what we need more of in today's world, right? Rather than people shrinking from something because it's unpopular or just going along with the narrative. I think that the more dialogue that we have, especially with influential people like you who are willing to speak their mind. I mean, I'm taking notes over here, right?
Well, Jonathan, just be clear. I did just contradict that point of view. I just said, as a CEO, you are your brand of your company.
Yeah.
You represent it. You can't speak as freely as you might like to. I stopped speaking about political issues to protect Whole Foods. It's a little bit like if people threaten your child, well, that might intimidate you to silence, right? It's like, we know where you live. We're going to get your beautiful daughter, Sailor, and we're going to hurt her unless you shut up. So they were threatening Whole Foods, and I backed down. So
I guess what I'm describing is I agree with you that as a leader, we have a solemn responsibility, and I try really hard to be careful with all of those things. What I'm describing, what I was complimenting you on, is your willingness to discuss that topic.
Okay. Fair enough.
Right?
Fair enough.
The willingness to have a dialogue about the real struggle and what that went through and what that was like versus sweeping it under the rug, putting it in your book.
Okay.
Let's talk
Thank
about
you.
Your sale to Amazon. I mean, that was something that kind of took a lot of, I mean, I was fortunate to be there for the process and to have conversations with you about it and to hear you talk about it off the stage. Talk about that, because I think that took a lot of people by surprise. And I know what led up to it. You talk about it, obviously, in the book as well. But maybe for the audience of folks here, that's the biggest question I get when people know that you and I are friends, is they ask, well, why in the world, if he believed in all this stuff, why did he sell to Amazon? So I'd love for, in your own words, for you to share that story.
I'll start out by saying that I get asked a lot, do I regret selling to Amazon? We sold to Amazon now 7 years ago. Do you regret it? And the honest answer is, I regret that the circumstances made that the best alternative for Whole Foods. And it was the best alternative. And if I had to go back again, faced with the same circumstances, I'd make the same decision. Of course, I'd rather have stayed independent. I mean, we had been independent at that point for 39 years. We've been independent. And I would have been happy to be independent forever. But we were under extreme pressure. Shareholder activists entered in and took a position in the stock, Jana Partners. And I met with them. They came down to Austin. We met. And a lot of times when you get shareholder activists, you had shared interests. They want to get the stock price higher, and so do we. We want to create more value for our shareholders. It's part of what they're an important stakeholder. So, but they didn't really want to work with us. When I said, let's work together to try to improve the stock price, they said, we don't want to work together. And I said, well, what do you want? He says, well, here's what we're going to do. First, we're going to take over your board. And then once we take over your board, we're going to fire you and your management team. And after we do that, we're going to put it up for sale to the highest bidder. And there's not a damn thing you can do about it. And then they walked out. So when we talk about cooperation and win-win-win, they certainly were not thinking that way.
I didn't read that chapter.
So then, I mean, we did lots of things. We did hire investment bankers and lawyers. We developed a plan to fight the activist. One of the ways they were going to try to replace our board is that we had a lot of board members that had been on the board 10, 15, 20 years, 25 years, even 30 years in one case. And to me, that's a good thing. These were people that loved our company, knew our company. But to governance, people that are professional governance experts, this was a board that was probably too chummy with management. And so they weren't doing their job. So that the very thing we considered a virtue, longevity, they considered to be a vice. And so we had to ask the investment bankers, the defensive investment banking firm we hired, Evercore, recommended that we replace these long-termed directors with those who were very well known but had no tenure at all. So we got a very good retail professional board that came in to replace it. That was our first defense. And then we began to map out a strategy of what we needed to do to get help get our profits up and our stock price up. So we had a whole plan to fight. We also were looking at other options, maybe selling the company to a friendly buyer that would let Whole Foods alone. And Warren Buffett would have been a perfect partner for us. We talked to Warren and he made a joke about it. Kind of, it's like, I own a Dairy Queen. I'm famous for kind of live on hamburgers and steaks. And I don't think this is a good brand fit for me.
Right.
And so that probably wasn't the case about the brand. He probably just had already didn't think we were a good investment for him. So that was out. And then it was, we could go private. We looked at going private, but the problem with going private is that you're basically giving control of your business over to a private equity firm who has similar interests that Jana had, except they put a massive amount of debt on the balance sheet. They borrow money temporarily to acquire the business. And then once they get control of it, they pay back that bridge loan they got to acquire it. And they borrow more money, long-term money, on the balance sheet of the company they acquire. So they would have put $12 or $13 billion onto Whole Foods in debt onto Whole Foods Market's balance sheet. And so would have had to spend all of our operating earnings or a lot of it to service the debt. If we had a downturn in our business, we could go bankrupt. We might destroy it. I just thought that risk was too high. Anyway, we were puzzled about what to do. And I kept asking the question every day, what's the win-win-win solution for all stakeholders? What's the win-win-win solution for all stakeholders? I kept putting that question out. You can say I put it out to the universe and also put it out to my deeper part of my being, my soul. And one day I woke up and the answer popped in my mind. What about Amazon? And I knew Amazon had been interested and they wanted to do more in the grocery business. They were struggling with their business, Amazon Fresh. And I had met Jeff Bezos a year before a Microsoft CEO summit. I got some quality time with Jeff. We talked at a mixer about books, fantasy fiction, science fiction, scuba diving. I'm an experienced diver and Jeff was new to it. I told him about the best places I dived in the world. And we kind of got along well. And then we were on a panel together, but just the two of us. And after that panel, we were talking and Jeff said, you know, you seem like a really interesting guy. Well, we should hang out. Let's talk. We can talk about Whole Foods. And I said, sure. But I never heard from Jeff after that. But I liked him. I thought, you know what? This is one of the great entrepreneurs of our era. And I think they would probably leave Whole Foods Market alone. We found a way to contact them and they were interested. And so I flew down there with three guys from my senior leaders on my team. The four of us went and met with Jeff and three leaders on his team. And we had an amazing 2.5 to 3 hour discussion about what it would be like if we merged companies. It was an amazing conversation. It's kind of like when you fall in love with somebody, you might have the conversation where you just have a meeting of souls.
Yep.
And they had so many good ideas and we had so many good ideas of how we could help each other that 2 days after that meeting, they sent a team down to do more due diligence on Whole Foods. And 6 weeks after that first meeting, we'd signed an agreement to get married. They ended up being the solution. And I have a lot more details on in it in the book, the Amazon solution. But it was just the best solution given the circumstances we were in because I didn't want to have the company sold against our will. I didn't want our board to be fired and I didn't want the management team to be fired. I didn't want, if we'd been sold to Kroger or Albertsons or some other supermarket company, what they would have surely done is they would have eliminated our corporate offices and taken it all into theirs. Our quality standards might have changed. They would be under a bribe. We'll call it a bribe from companies like Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, the big food companies who want to sell their products at Whole Foods. And we have quality standards. So we don't sell a lot of the items they want us to sell. Those quality standards would have been watered down. Our culture would have been changed. All the supermarkets are heavily unionized. And I actually had a meeting with Albertsons on an informal basis. And I talked about it and I asked him a question. I said, what percentage of your company is unionized? He said, 75%. CEO did. I said, 75%? Wow, it's a lot more than I realized. And he said, oh, John, don't worry about the unions. They're going to leave you alone. And I said, no, they're not. They're not going to leave us alone. They're not going to leave us alone.
You already have to agree with that.
So you have to see the context of what was happening then and what our alternatives were available to us. Amazon was the best solution. And then I go into some detail in the book towards the end about summing it all up about Amazon. Most of that merger has been really good for Whole Foods. And I go into great detail about people don't say whole paycheck very much anymore. Part of the reason why is Amazon let us cut our prices 4 times in the first 2 years. If we'd stayed private, do you know how hard it is to cut prices when you have quarterly earnings pressure? If you're selling something for a dollar and you start selling it for 90 cents, in the long run, that's a good strategy. you'll get more business. In the short run, your sales just drop 10%. Your comp sales, your same store sales plummet. Your profits plummet. And when you've got activist investors, you're just toast. So Amazon not only dropped our prices, they gave everybody in the whole, everybody in the company got a pay raise within a month of the acquisition, even though that lowered our profitability considerably. Technology, that's a wasn't a strength of Whole Foods. When COVID hit, they were able to scale us up for delivery. They spent tens and tens and millions of dollars to get Whole Foods up to delivery very quickly. And during the COVID, we were very, very good at delivery, and delivery became a large percentage of our total sales. And they delivered for free, which I was arguing with them the whole time. Don't deliver for free. My God. I mean, it costs us $20 to make a delivery, and you're going to do it for free? It's going to wipe out all of our profits. And they are, again, we're thinking long term and said, we're going to do it anyway. So Amazon's been a good partner for Whole Foods, not a perfect partner. I talk about some of the cultural differences that are there, but overall, a good partner. Most importantly, they didn't try to change us.
Right.
They let Whole Foods be Whole Foods. They didn't try to convert us into Amazon.
And I think the details around that in the book, the whole story, is key. Last question for you, because I know we're getting long on time. Yeah. It's easy to do when we get together and talk about topics we're both passionate about. But tell us about your next venture. I mean, it's something that you and I would talk about on walks and kind of what your next iteration is, and something that I'm grateful to be able to be a small investor in. But I just would love for you to kind of share the next iteration of your life, because of the way you've treated your body and your health. You have a lot of life left, and you're still very full of energy and full of life. And I remember, I think at a dinner at your house one day, you said you're more excited today than you are even when you were younger building Whole Foods. So talk about this next phase of your life and what that looks like and what your new mission is.
I'm actually fulfilling a lot of details about it in the book, obviously, but I've had this dream about, and I almost did it way back in 1989 with something called LifeWorks, but I said 89, no, 85, almost did it in 85, but the dream that didn't happen then, but it's happening now in a much larger form. And the name of the new business is called Love Life. And so we've acquired a few little businesses. We've got a telehealth business. It's now called Love Life Telehealth. If you go onto our website, www.love.life, you can see, not love.life.com, just love.life, you can see what we're doing right now. And we have a telehealth business. We have an online coaching business for people that have diabetes or want to lose weight, that might be overweight or obese. We acquired a restaurant in Miami called Love Life. That's where we got our brand name from. They're a really good plant-based restaurant in Miami that I would urge people to try. But what I'm really excited about is we're about to open in July 9th in LA, in the LA area, El Segundo, in the Beach Cities area. We're opening up an old Best Buy, a 45,000 square foot holistic health membership club. And let me describe what that is briefly. So we're basically putting five things together under this Love Life vision. The first one is we're going to have a healthy food restaurant. It's not going to be a strictly plant-based restaurant like one in Miami. It's going to be what we call plant forward. Think of sweet greens. You can create salads and bowls and sandwiches, mains, and you can add high quality animal foods to those meals, or make it the center of the plate if you wish. It's going to be a very healthy restaurant. And secondly, we're opening up a state-of-the-art fitness center. Here you can think something like Equinox. We have a lot of very advanced equipment that you won't generally find in an Equinox either, that helps people to do very quick, fast workouts. We're going to have a spa, so you'll be able to get massages or facials or lots of different wraps and exfoliants and things that people do in spas. We have all this restorative equipment like cold plunges, infrared saunas, cryotherapy, regular saunas, hyperbaric oxygen chamber, and lymphatic massage table, and all kinds of interesting, cool stuff that we're doing there. And we also have an element of play, because we're going to have three pickleball courts inside the facility. And I think we'll get people to join up just to play pickleball, if nothing else.
Yeah. And then I want to move in. I mean, I just make a little apartment in the corner and I'll move in.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping you're going to visit soon after it opens. Then the most important part, I say for last, we have a medical center. And so let me ask you a question. When do most people go see a doctor?
When they're sick.
Exactly. Our vision is to change the way people think about doctors over the next 20 years, where the doctor's job is to keep you from getting sick. And so we now have this technology where we can, particularly the chronic diseases, you're still going to get colds and things like that. But if you look at the causes of death in the United States, they're not from infectious diseases. They're primarily from what we would call chronic diseases. So the biggest killer in America is heart attacks. Second biggest is cancer. Then you've got stroke, and you have various autoimmune type diseases that can kill us. And modern medicine doesn't cure these diseases. They manage the symptoms of the diseases, but they don't reverse them. And what we believe is the best strategy is never to get those chronic diseases in the first place. And if you get them, to detect them at a very early age and working with the medical team and a wellness coach to reverse the diseases. So our vision is we have this technology now that allows us to do a deep assessment. So let's take you as an example, Jonathan. You'd come in, you could do a battery of tests, and we could give you a complete health report, something you might get at the Mayo Clinic or the Cleveland Clinic. We're going to do that at Love Life. We're going to give you a Jonathan Kaiser report. A doctor will go over it with you. And then if you're interested, we're going to try to develop, put you in one of our medical health plans to help you to become the healthiest version of yourself. How do we customize this for you as an individual? Our doctors are trained in functional medicine, lifestyle medicine, integrative medicine. So they're going to be able to work with you on an individualized basis, and we'll have a wellness coach working with you. Now we have these wearables, such as Apple Watch, Oura Rings, Garmin devices, continuous glucose monitors. We have ways to gather the data, collate it, have your wellness coach and you seeing it and talking about it. And then we basically can see if you're making progress or not. And if you're not making progress, well, they're going to figure out the reason why and modify the tweak the plan accordingly. So that's the health vision, but it's more than just physical health that we're going to try to work with. We really want to help people on an emotional, psychological, and spiritual level. So we will, for example, have meditation classes and meditation gatherings at Love Life. We already have stated we'll have yoga and Pilates. We will have breath work. For people who've never done breath work, breath work is an amazing way to have transcendent experiences just by continuous deep breathing in a guided way.
Yeah, you talk about that in your other book.
Talk about it in the book. It's had a huge impact on me. And then when it's legal, and it will be legal in some form or fashion, we will also do psychedelic therapy, particularly MDMA and psilocybin.
Why that?
Because the science is now so clear now. These substances were taken out of science for decades. When the drug warriors got scared, they outlawed all these drugs, even for scientific study. But over the last decade or so, last 10, 15 years, they've been legalized again for study, for scientific research. And what they've discovered is that PTSD is particularly useful for veterans that have been seeing combat, but quite frankly, almost everyone has some PTSD in them from childhood abuse or some traumatic experiences that have happened that have just been suppressed down, but that still manifest in our lives with irrational behaviors. A combination of MDMA and psilocybin has proven to be remarkably effective in eliminating PTSD in people. And that's why this is going to be legalized for medical therapeutic uses. It's already been legalized in Oregon and Colorado, for example. I think California won't be very many years behind. It'll be regulated. It'll be licensed. You'll have to be trained in it. But because this can take these deep emotional states and give us healing on it, I mean, they have like talk therapy has like a 1% healing rate on these, and group therapies have like a 1% healing on PTSD. These psychoactive substances can heal up to 80%.
Wow.
80% of people can be healed completely from their PTSD. Yeah, that's just amazing.
Like, psychedelics are for hippies and, you know, like this whole, so there needs to be a shift in,
yes,
in mindset around these substances.
Correct. That's happening. The drug warriors, for the most part, have died. And we have a new scientific interest in these substances. And again, regulated appropriately, used responsibly, not say recreationally, but used in a medical setting can be extremely helpful for people. And Love Life is about helping individuals to be the best version of yourself. How do we make Jonathan Kaiser the very best version of yourself, physically, emotionally, and spiritually?
Well, and I love that. And I also think, you know, you look at what's happening today post-pandemic, mental health challenges are through the roof. And so, you know, you started Whole Foods to change how people eat and create health there. To me, this is exactly like you just stated, a extension of that, where now you're taking it to their entire life, not just the food that they put in their body.
Right.
And just like you were a visionary back in the day when people thought you were crazy for doing what you're doing, you probably have those people today that don't see the vision. When Love Life is fully built out and, you know, mature, what does that look like? What do you see in the world from there?
I see Love Life's all in every major city in the United States and eventually the world. That's what I see happening. And we'll have lots of copy imitators that will be doing similar things once we prove it works. And so the world's going to change. And Whole Foods changed the way people eat. It's a simple fact. I mean, people today that aren't old enough to remember what supermarkets were like when Whole Foods got cranking up, about the first 20 years Whole Foods existed, people would come into our stores and they'd say, I've never been in a store like this. This is incredible, because our stores were beautiful.
Yeah.
The produce was abundant, and you just, the supermarkets back in the day were very sort of dingy, crummy places to go. And due to Whole Foods, they've upped their game and they've considerably improved. And not just Whole Foods, of course. I mean, there are other factors, but I think the similar thing is going to play out, except faster, because now we have social media. Now we have these remote technologies. Everybody has a smartphone. Good ideas, they don't stay hidden long. Whole Foods flew under the radar for a long time before people actually woke up to us. I don't think it'll be the case with Love Life.
No. As always, I mean, I have scratched a whole bunch of notes. To anyone that's growing a business or is just a human in today's world, reading the whole story is highly recommended, and you will be glad that you did. And I urge you to go to Amazon, download and purchase the whole story by John Mackey, and then make sure that you go and comment, give him a rating. We want this story to spread. We want more people to understand the journey. And especially as entrepreneurs, it's very helpful to us to understand that we're not alone in a lot of these same struggles that you've gone through, other CEOs and entrepreneurs are going through today.
You can also get the book at, not every Whole Foods market selling it, because a few of the smaller Whole Foods don't have any books, but any Whole Foods that sells any books is selling the whole story right now. So you can also come go pick it up.
Buy five, give them to your friends. Well, John, it's been an honor. Thank you for taking the time. Thank you for putting yourself out there as always. Thank you for your friendship. Thank you for your leadership in the world. And I think that it already is true today, but I think 50 years from now, people will look back and say you were probably one of the top three most influential business leaders of our time. And me personally, I'm grateful to know you. I'm grateful to be associated with you. And I'm grateful for the impact that you've had in my life and business. So thanks for coming on the Jonathan Kaiser podcast. And I look forward to many, many positive years ahead together.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to hit subscribe so future episodes are automatically downloaded directly to your device. And if you want access to today's show notes, including links to all the resources mentioned, visit Kaiser.com/podcast. That's Kaiser.com/podcast. Thanks again for listening, and I will catch you next week for another episode of the Jonathan Kaiser podcast.